So I usually start off with this lecture, again, not the most positive way to start it off with, but the leading causes of death. So today, of course, is recognizing women with heart disease, and that does affect more women than any cancer combined. And so the number one killer for both men and female is heart disease. And so that's really going to be a large focus of the lecture, since that seems to affect most Americans in some way, shape, or form, whether it's just through high blood pressure or unmanaged cholesterol. The next issue is cancer. And what we're really focusing on is lifestyle cancer. So cancers such as colon, esophageal, stomach cancer, breast cancer, prostate cancers, the cancers that are really tied with lifestyle interventions. Next, we have stroke, which is just a heart attack for the brain. And then, COPD, chronic lower respiratory disorder. I work with a lot of pulmonary patients at the hospital, and we used to just think it was because of cigarette, tobacco, or environmental toxins. But now we know that nutrition is a really large focus with COPD patients. Unintentional injuries, Alzheimer's, diabetes, influenza pneumonia, kidney issues, and this bottom one is suicide. So of this top 10, we mentioned a few having to do with food, but how many would you guess have a basis in nutrition? Just spit out some numbers. I mean, you could argue all of them, but unintentional injuries, you trip over a strawberry. I don't know if that's really, I don't know if we could argue that. But, most of these do have a basis in nutrition. That's what we're going to focus on today. So, we're sick. Most Americans over the age of 55 either have high blood pressure, they're on a statin. One in three of us are going to die from heart disease, one in four from cancer. 30% are obese, and 68% of us are overweight. So we're a sick, sick country. And unfortunately, our ways are traveling overseas, and we're affecting now other countries by our eating habits. And what we define as the standard American diet is traveling overseas. So over 75% of the cost of our healthcare is due to preventable issues. And so this huge debate that we have going on in the government is really, in my opinion, it's sort of a moot point, because what we're arguing about is who should pay for disease, whether it's the insurer or the insuree or the government. But what we really should be focusing on is not the demand, but the supply side of it, is getting people not to go into the system to begin with. And that, of course, is what we're going to define today through nutrition. Right now, how our diet looks in this country hasn't changed much in the last 5 to 10 years, and that's not a good thing. About 51% of what we consume comes in a box, a bag, a carton. It's processed or refined in some way, shape, or form. And people oftentimes, when they come in, especially in the hospital, and they say, I'm not eating a lot of processed food. And I say, are you having yogurt? Are you having lunch meat? Do you have bread that has an ingredient list on there that's about this long? And they say, well, I have sandwiches, and I have yogurt and pretzels. Well, that's all processed food, and so that's not whole food, which isn't going to help us out much. The next problem is about 42% of what we consume actually comes from an animal. And it's not necessarily that animal foods are devastating for us, but they can be in more than very, very minute small amounts. And so that's something, too, that is not specific to America, but we do have a ton of animal protein and products within our diets. Only 7% of what the typical American consumes actually heals the body. And so we see why we're in this state of sickness and state of disease. If you compare roughly 114 years ago to now, we eat much differently. So in 1900, and this is per capita, so per person per year, we were consuming about 5 pounds per person per year of sugar. Now if you take a look, we're consuming about 190 pounds of sugar per person per year. And shockingly enough, this is not coming from your dessert. People say, I'm cutting out dessert so I don't eat sugar. Well, if you have cold breakfast cereal, again, back to the lunch meat. If you have the typical lunch meat, if you have yogurt, if you have crackers, cookies, chips, all of those things generally have added sugar in it, and that's what's adding to this 190 pounds per person per year. If you pinpoint oils and fat, about 4 pounds per person per year, now we're up to about 74 pounds. Cheese specifically, nothing in cheese helps us. There's nothing in cheese that we can't find in other things. And we are only consuming about 2 pounds per person per year. Now look at this, 30. That's from our pizzas, our burritos, our mac and cheeses, cheese that's laden on everything. Meat consumption was about 140 pounds per person per year. Now we're up to about 210. Fruits and vegetables, this is probably the most staggering, and in my opinion, why we're in this state of disease, 131 pounds per person per year, now 11. We just don't consume real plant-based foods anymore, the foods that we're meant to thrive on. Look at the caloric density here, about 2,100 calories, now we're up to about 2,700 calories. The nutrient density has gone down almost 60%. Soft drinks, which were non-existent in 1900, we're having about 53 gallons per person per year. And that includes diet sodas as well, which there's nothing in there that helps us. And then just to also give the point that diet is one factor behind this, but it's also the fact of our moving. We're sitting more. We're driving in our cars as opposed to riding our bikes or walking. We're watching more TV. We're on our computers more. We're on our iPads and phones more. So we're just not as active as we used to be. So again, what we're going to take a look at is the scientific evidence that shows that we need to get back to the basics, and that's eating real food and making most of our diet out of real plant-based food. So what does that look like? So that looks like meals that are surrounded with four key items, and that is vegetables, fruits, whole grains, and then of course legumes, which I'll define. This is what we want to focus on avoiding, so I'll bring up the bad stuff first. And again, anything that has an ingredient list is processed in some way, shape, or form. It's not necessarily that we need to avoid that, but we need to make sure that we read the ingredient list of everything that we're purchasing, and that way we're not having chemicals and added preservatives, food coloring, things that aren't meant to be in our diet, or they're concentrated versions of food, such as oil, salt, or sugar is what I call as SOS. So we want to avoid the added sugars. And again, 17% of the sugar we consume comes from cold breakfast cereal. If you take a look at Cheerios, for example, the second ingredient of Cheerios is modified cornstarch. What is that? Sugar. The third ingredient is outright sugar, but if they called all of it sugar, it would be the number one ingredient in Cheerios. And so people think that that's a health product, again, because of the big heart in the box. But I always tell everyone, never believe the front of a package. That's there to market to you. So the bigger the heart, the bigger the bull, right? And so you never, ever, ever want to believe that. You always go straight to the ingredient list and take a look and see what's actually in that product that they're marketing to you as something that's heart healthy. And common sense tells us that things that are truly healthy for us, we know they don't market to us. You know, do we have campaigns for broccoli, avocados, grapes, apples? I mean, we don't really, unfortunately. I wish we did, because that way people might understand or start to get back to basics that it's real food that helps us out. Processed foods in boxes and bags, we talked about that. All added oil. Oil is not a whole food. It's a fragment. It's a part of a food. And so we have an olive. Excellent. We have a coconut. Fabulous. We have corn. Fine in some cases, but we're not going to get into that debate today. But when you draw out oil from that product, you're what's creating a fragment or a really concentrated source of that particular oil or fat. And the bodies don't respond to that well. Our bodies are designed to eat the food on how it's naturally packaged. And so the Mediterranean diet has become very, very popular. And I'll go into more details on why that's not the best diet. Is it better than the standard American diet? Well, what isn't? Right? So again, that's what the studies have compared it to. And so of course it looks good in a study. You know, you have to look, A, who's funding the study, and B, what sort of is the motive behind putting that study out there. So the latest study was put out by the country of Spain, and so they're the biggest exporters of olive oil, right? And so we kind of have to take that with a grain of salt in regards to the studies that come out and really looking to what they're comparing it to, the standard American diet. Next, we have all sweetened beverages. This includes all sodas. Again, they're just chemicals in a can. Diet sodas are even worse, and things like Crystal Light or any of those chemical concoctions that are added to water are something that's not meant for our body. We're not meant to thrive on these chemicals. Table salt, we know that, but most of the salt does not come from what we sprinkle. It comes from those boxes, the bags, the lunch meats, the ice creams, the yogurts, all of that that is very, very laden with sodium and salt products. Dairy, this is something that is not meant for us. You know, dairy includes milk, cheese, butter, yogurt, and ice cream. And yogurt right now has had a huge release in the mainstream of something that's considered healthy in the diet. So again, I'll be going into more detail on that. This is just showing the example of when you take real food, it goes bad. It has energy, it's live food. So after 80 days, that's what our watermelon looks like, right? Take a look at a hamburger and french fries after 180 days from McDonald's. Not much change. And so the reason for that is it is preserved. It's not real food. It's edible, but it's completely void of nourishment. Look at that. 180 days, it doesn't look any different, not even the bun. And so again, it's just going back to basics. This is not difficult information. People are focusing on the latest fad diets, and it's so confusing, and the nutritional messages out there can be really overwhelming and bombard us. But again, just going back to basics and concentrating our efforts on eating real food and not food that looks the same after 180 days. So refined sugar. So the problem with the refined sugar that was obviously in that McDonald's hamburger, as well as the bun and the french fries, and a lot of the processed food that I've named, is that it depletes our immune function. And so that's going to affect every disease state that we could possibly get. When we get older, we're more susceptible to colds and flus. And then, of course, refined sugar is something that just accelerates that process. For the patients that I work with at the hospital, once they're out of the hospital, they're still susceptible to diseases and infections. And so refined sugar just puts a perfect storm for zapping that immune function and opening those doors up for hospital-borne infections or infections post-surgery. Now, with this, it also elevates our insulin levels, which we know. But again, it's not necessarily the desserts. Of course, that's one element, but it's all that processed food that we defined. It raises our cholesterol. Sugar doesn't have cholesterol, but what it does is it works as a transport system. And so when we eat that burger with that milkshake, that's a perfect way to get that cholesterol within our vessels. And so it's just a vehicle to get the cholesterol in and to utilize it in a non-effective way. And then it increases our triglycerides. So folks have problems with cholesterol, lipid panels, or triglycerides. Sugar is one of those things that we definitely want to cut back on by just cutting out processed foods. Now, artificial sweetener, it's artificial. It's not real, whether you're talking about stevia, xylitol, aspartame, NutraSweet, Splenda. These are all artificial sweeteners that have been processed in some way, shape, or form. And some people say, well, stevia is real. You know, it comes from a plant. Well, so does cocaine. It doesn't make it good for us, right? And so these are things I want you to focus on. It's not necessarily where it's come from, but how it's processed and how it's gotten to that package that we need to really focus on. So when people, especially for type 2 diabetics, this is so important to stay away from. The body doesn't know the difference between having real sugar and having something that's artificial. So your blood sugar may not spike, but what happens is your pancreas then dumps out insulin into the body. And inevitably what happens is then you have uncontrolled type 2 diabetes because you're having too much artificial sweetener. For those of you who raised your hand because you're on a blood pressure medication, artificial sweetener is not your friend. It's usually processed with heavy metals, such as cadmium, and that's something that can really contribute to high blood pressure in conjunction with other things that we're doing in our diet. Now, trans fat, this became hot and heavy in the news about 3 months ago, how they were going to talk about taking it out of our food system. And again, to me, that's a moot point. That's something that shouldn't even be on the conversation list, because once you say to a Kellogg's or General Mills, you can no longer use trans fat, well, what do you think they're going to do? They're going to try to find something else, some other chemical that preserves their product, increases shelf life, and increases the taste or texture of their product that's still fake. And so again, we're sort of chasing the industry as opposed to just saying, don't buy it. Just eat real food. Don't buy stuff that's made with chemical concoctions. With a trans fat, this is devastating for coronary artery disease. About a 20% increase in just 2 grams a day. And 2 grams a day is found in about 20 wheat thins, so that much. So again, 2 grams is not a lot that can devastate the body. And again, it's fake. It's not meant for us. So I wanted to talk about dairy. So what dairy is it's breast milk of a cow that's meant to have that baby cow grow very fast and very effectively. And no one in here is a baby cow, right? And so it's silly that we should be consuming the milk of another species, right? It's kind of bizarre. But for the last 150 years, us and primarily the European countries have really been focusing on dairy. And us in the European countries have the highest amount of osteoporosis, cancer, and heart disease. There's about 4 billion people in the world that don't consume dairy at all. Is anyone a guess of what those cultures are? Asia, right? You go to a Japanese restaurant, not a lot of Parmesan cheese there to sprinkle on your sushi. They're just not a big cheese type of traditional food. And with that type of traditional food, they have less heart disease, they have less cancer, strokes, diabetes, etc. With the dairy, it is wonderful for a baby cow, but when you take the milk of another species that's not meant for it, it's something that the body starts to attack itself. And that's why we have a whole flourishing element of autoimmune diseases that are happening within this country. Child allergies, yes, especially by what the mother has consumed during gestation and then what the kids are given within the first 5 years of life. So as you can see, our cheese increased to astronomical amounts per person per year. Again, it's just not meant for us. The casein, so even when people say, well, what about low-fat cheese? What about cottage cheese or yogurt? Well, the fat isn't the only problem. The other problem is the casein. That's spelled C-I-S-E-I-N, casein, and that's the protein that's found within that dairy product. that's actually a really known high carcinogen. And so it leads to different cancers. We know for a fact that it's a strong correlation with prostate cancer, ovarian cancer, and then of course with obesity as well. It's just not meant for us, guys. It's meant for the cow. You know, we wean ourselves off of breast milk when we're infants, but then decide to take on the milk of another species after the age of two. It just doesn't make sense. It's not natural, and the body tends to turn on itself because of that nature. So this is something that with the cancer growth, it's something called IGF. It's insulin growth-like factor 1. So for folks who have a susceptibility or gene for type 1 diabetes, if they're given cow's milk at a young age, that gene is going to be more likely to present itself and express itself. In other words, you're going to have a higher risk or a higher chance of actually having type 1 diabetes if you consume milk and have the gene for it. It's a really powerful stimulus for cancer. It is something, again, it's not a powerful stimulus for cancer in a cow, but it is for us because that milk is not meant for us. I wanted to really talk about oil. Again, we focus so much on, decreasing saturating fats, decreasing this. But again, it's when we talk in terms of generalities and in very vague terms, people just look for labels of things that have low saturated fat or low fat in general. But again, it's about the added oil. This is not a whole food. It is very, very caloric dense, very nutrient poor, about 120 calories per tablespoon. So if you're at Carrabba's and you're having the bread there, 120 calories, 120 calories, 120 calories. So for weight management, oil is not your friend. For baking and cooking at home, it's really simple to take the oil out. You know, you can use any type of liquid whatsoever, whether that's water, whether that's beer, whether it's wine, vinegar, soy sauce, any type of juice. Whatever it is something that it'll take on that texture and the taste, and it's not something that you're going to miss. It's not something that you'll really notice much of a taste difference. Does anyone not cook with oil at home right now? Great. Okay, good. So a few people already doing this. That's a great thing. For baking, it's so easy to remove the oil from the recipes. Anything that calls for oil, you can use any type of pureed fruit, especially applesauce, bananas, baby food prunes, that gives it a nice, rich, moist taste without having that added, refined part of a food. You can use whole foods instead for your cooking and baking. So this is from Dr. Esselstyn, and for him, he's a huge advocate of no oil, especially for folks who have known blockages. And so I'll read this word for word. Oils contain saturated fat, which immediately injures the endothelial lining of the arteries. Endothelial are the cells that line every artery in our body. It doesn't matter whether it's olive, corn, or any oil whatsoever. So again, oil is oil is oil. I get the question all the time, well, is olive oil better than safflower, or is safflower better than coconut? It's all oil, and it should really be limited in the diet. This is a picture of the endothelial cell under a microscope, and our healthy endothelial cells are just a wonder for us and what they do for us. A healthy endothelial cell is going to manufacture and make nitric oxide. Has anyone heard of nitroglycerin that you put under the tongue? Yep. So nitroglycerin is something that does what to the arteries? Does it make them dilated or does it squeeze them? It dilates them to let the blood flow come in, correct? Well, our body has its own manufacturing plant for nitric oxide, and that's really, really, really powerful healing and prevention for heart disease or anything that has to do with blood flow in particular, whether it is heart disease, strokes, ED, arthritis, all of that has to do with proper blood flow. And so when our endothelial cells are not working properly, then we don't manufacture as much nitric oxide. It resolves general inflammation in the body. So most of the chronic diseases that we've talked about have a strong basis and correlation with inflammation. It normalizes angiogenesis. And angiogenesis, just in its pure definition, is making of blood vessels. And so you would think that we'd want more of that. But let's say, for example, someone has a cancerous tumor. Do we want to bring a blood supply to that? No, absolutely not. And so what it does is it helps to resolve and normalize angiogenesis of when we should be making blood cells and then when we shouldn't, of course. It helps to prevent atherosclerosis by having healthy endothelial. It prevents cancer, and it's the key to most diseases. Here's what damages our endothelial cells. So number one, sugar, what we've talked about. It's very, very, very pro-inflammatory. Any type of saturated fat, and we find saturated fat from two sources, animals and oil. Those are the only two sources of saturated fat. Next, we have alcohol, stress, more specifically cortisol that gets traveled through our body, sleep deprivation, salt, low vitamin D. And I'm not talking about low vitamin D from a supplement. I'm talking about low vitamin D from a lack of sunshine. low B vitamins. And then we have pesticides, dyes, the food coloring that's in our food system. This all contributes to the damage of our endothelial cells. And fast food. Fast food is a perfect storm of SOS, salt, oil, and sugar, and then you compile all the chemicals that are in it. It is something that is just a tragic depletion and zaps our endothelial cells within 2 hours. Now, here are the diseases that are related to endothelial damage. So number one, of course, is diabetes. And what we're talking about is not specifically type 2 diabetes, but type 1 as well. Atherosclerosis, heart disease, strokes, hypertension, multiple sclerosis, lupus, scleroderma, RA, cancer, ALS, Parkinson's, coagulation issues, renal failure, metabolic syndrome, sleep apnea, and glaucoma. So when we mess with our endothelial, we can see the magnitude of what happens to us when we're not eating in a way that helps to protect endothelial cells. This is just a series of studies, and the content of this slide is not as important as that we've known this for decades, that plants help to heal the endothelial. Again, it's the food that we're meant to thrive on. More plants, more real food. And so if we eat these types of foods, we're going to have that protective element against the damage of the endothelial cells. Here's the food specifically. It's the antioxidants, the phytonutrients and chemicals found within the plant-based food that actually help to heal the endothelial. So for the patients who've had the stents, like we talked about Sonia in the beginning, or any of the heart patients that I work with, when they switch their diet, it is unbelievable to see, A, how quickly they feel better, but not only that, their catheterizations and how it makes a difference in regards to their arteries cleaning out very, very fast, faster and really more effectively than any possible medication that can do for them. Exercise, so it's not just about what we're consuming, but how much we're moving as well. Vitamin D from the sunshine. Omega-3 fatty acids, not from a supplement, from whole foods. Leafy greens, whole grains, those are great sources of omega-3. Of course, nuts and seeds as well. Healthy fats, liver detox. Now, I'm not a huge supplement fan, but there's so much evidence out there with milk thistle and liver detoxifying that I couldn't not put it here. Just a lot of research to show that a milk thistle is really helpful to detoxify the liver that we do to it every day. And then, of course, the protein that's found in vegetables. And for a lot of folks, that can be shocking that they didn't think vegetables had protein. But that's actually fruits, vegetables, legumes, whole grains, they all contain the amount of protein that we need to thrive. This is what our plate should look like. This is borrowed from PCRM, Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine. And that is a wonderful resource for both clinicians as well as consumers to get great information on diseases as well as how we should eat in some of the latest studies that are out there. So let's focus on the positive now. So what should we be eating? And of course, that's more fruits and vegetables. You know, we know this. Everyone intrinsically knows that we should be consuming more fruits and vegetables. But the issue here is why? They're nature's medicine. And it was Hippocrates that said that. Yep. So it's the food should be our medicine. And with this, this is going to do more for you than your statin. It's going to do more for you than your beta blocker. It's going to do more for you than your Diavan, your Atenolol. Whatever you're taking to help is not getting at the root cause. The fruit and vegetable will actually heal that endothelial, so the body will get back into balance and heal itself. It's really important to consume a variety of fruit and vegetables. So we learned about Michelle's Co-op today, and we have farmers markets downtown, both in Bradenton and downtown Sarasota and Venice, Philippi Shores. And we're so lucky here that we have access to really good, locally grown, great fruits and vegetables. And so we really have no excuse to purchase that and year-round in Florida. So there's a magic number, and this may seem like a lot of folks who are currently not consuming a high fruit and vegetable diet, but it's 8. Eight a day. I say it because they say you need to hear something 7 times for it to sink in, right? So what I do is a serving size is about the size of a tennis ball. So when someone comes into cardiac rehab, okay, we have in the back treatment room, we have 8 tennis balls sitting on our treatment table. And it's always a great conversation piece, but what it does is it lends us to say, this is how many servings of fruit and vegetable that you should be consuming in a day if you have known blockages or known heart disease. And so that's really easy to get if we're consuming fruit at every breakfast, vegetables for a snack, vegetables at every lunch. And this is the missing link. As Americans, we as a whole do not consume vegetables at most lunches. Raise your hand if you consume vegetables every day at every lunch. Okay? And this is the, and obviously we have a lot of veggies here and veg meetup people. But in a typical room, I may have of 20 people, 1 or 2 people raise their hand. So just to show you that the average American doesn't consume any vegetables at lunch whatsoever. And then, of course, incorporating the vegetables into the dinner and fruit as a snack. It's something that's going to help your blood flow. Again, it all boils back to the endothelial cell and making sure that you're keeping it healthy and maintaining a good number as well as quality of them as well. Dark leafy green vegetables. This is in particular something that is just a wonder food. This is something that in spinach in particular contains 13 flavonoids with anti-cancer properties. This is especially effective against prostate, skin, colon, and bone cancer. These are powerful, powerful antioxidants that play a role in blocking early stages of cancer. Right now, every single one of us is fighting cancer. We are constantly fighting off carcinogens in our body. But it becomes a point when we zap our immune function to eat in a way that we can't protect ourselves that cancer starts to form. And there's always exceptions to that rule. But for the most part, if we are able to boost our immune function, we're able to ward off those carcinogens so they don't grow into tumors that become cancerous tumors. This is something that has to do with genes. Genetic testing is huge right now within the medical and the science world. And that has a basis, and I think that can be appropriate. But what's the point of telling someone, oh, you have that breast cancer gene that your mom has, you have that heart disease gene that your dad has, if you're not also giving that person, you know, a little bit of hope? That's sort of a fatalist mentality to me, that we're sort of a victim to our own genes, and that's not the case. Just because we have a gene for a specific disease doesn't mean that it will express itself. So lifestyle has a lot to do with that. So we now know that we can turn off a specific gene, 9P21, which is the worst gene to have for heart disease. We know that we can squash and turn off that gene by what we consume. And specifically, that's vegetables, even more specific, whole leafy green vegetables, broccoli, kale, collards, spinach. Those are all something that help to turn that gene off. So in my family, heart disease runs rampant. My father's had 2 heart attacks. My mom is morbidly obese. She has type 2 diabetes. And they are not doing much to change their diet. And so this was something that, as a younger person, I always had higher cholesterol than what you would imagine for someone in their 20s. And, you know, my mom always said, as a nurse, oh, it's your genes. There's nothing you can do about it. It's your genes. Well, it wasn't until that someone wanted to put me on a statin that I decided that I need to sort of look into this and sort of change my ways. And doing the research and getting to the field that I am, I realized that, gosh, I can turn this around significantly. So at age 25, my total cholesterol was 425. Is that good or bad? And I was about the same size. I was always really active. I was a dancer. I ate what I thought was fairly healthy. But I had that strong genetic basis for heart disease in particular. Well, now my total cholesterol runs maybe 102, maybe. And so, again, I haven't changed anything. I haven't taken any statins. It's just giving your body what it needs so that gene doesn't express itself. So, again, one of the reasons why I'm so passionate about this is because I know the personal story behind it and how it can really help. Whole grains. If you are type 2 diabetic, don't stay away from these. You want to stay away from the refined carbohydrates, the fake carbs, but those good nourishing whole grains are something that, you know, are nourishing and fantastic for the body, just like the fruit and vegetable. So the quinoas, the farro, the millet, these are wonderful, wonderful grains for us that we should be incorporating within our diet. Brown rices, rolled oats, buckwheat. You know, we have this huge grain brain going on, and wheat belly, the books that are out. And again, our wheat has changed a little bit in terms of how it's processed and structured. But don't stay away from all grains. This is something that can be very, very nourishing for the body. It's something that won't necessarily bring up your blood sugar, especially if you're combining it with other good foods as well. So please don't stay away from grains because you think that they're bad carbs. It's only the refined processed food that's so bad for us. So again, like the fruits and vegetables, the fiber, the phytonutrients, the antioxidants are what's going to help us heal. It also helps with our GI system, making transit time just a little bit faster. Also helping with blood pressure and cholesterol as well. Helps to transport through that liver effectively and getting it out of our body. So don't give up whole grains just because you think that wheat is bad for everybody. It's something that is very nourishing for us. Now, diabetes, and Kathy was talking in the beginning about her type 2 diabetes. This is something with diabetes. People were always told that it was a sugar problem, you know, that you have a carbohydrate issue. And we now know that that's actually not the case, that it's more having to do with fat and oil. The fat and oil kind of gets gunked up in our cell, and the insulin can't get in. So if we can get that fat and oil out of our body and out of the cells, then the insulin can do a better job at getting into the cells, and that's called insulin sensitivity. So getting it into the cells so the cells aren't resistant to it. So the carbohydrates carbohydrates from fruit, vegetable, whole grains, and legumes, those are carbs that, everything is a carb that comes from the plant kingdom. So when someone's saying, I'm not having carbohydrates, well, then what are you eating? Because everything that comes from the plant kingdom has carbohydrate. It's again, that refined carb that we really need to focus on. The white flours, the white sugars, and all the processed stuff that's within our lunch meats, breads, crackers, cookies, and yogurts. So people oftentimes have a question about protein. Protein is a non-issue if you are consuming most of your calories from plants. And here's why. Protein is found in heavy hitters such as beans, it's lentils, raw nuts, and seeds. This is something that is, you know, heavy hitters for protein. So instead of having chicken in your burrito, a bean burrito is something that can be fantastic. Instead of having ground beef within your spaghetti, add some kidney beans in there. And the African stew that Tom was saying that he made had no meat in it as well. So everything that comes from the plant kingdom still has an element of protein in it. A banana itself, 10% of a banana's calories come from protein. And for the human, we need about 10% of our calories to come from protein. So look at our closest relative, the gorilla, right? So what does a gorilla thrive on? Bananas and greens, correct? And they're not a wimpy, you know, sort of a frail-looking creature. It's a very, very hearty, meaty, for lack of a better term, creature. And so this is something that, too, our closest relatives are plant-based eaters, and they thrive significantly. With legumes, the people who consume more than 4 servings per week but a 22% less likely chance to develop heart disease, and that was done out of a study of Harvard University. And with the legumes, what they really can help with, again, is the blood pressure, the cholesterol, the hypertension, the diabetes, the things that we've been focusing on that I know that for a lot of folks are battling here in this room. Now let's get to meat. So for most folks, I actually hate the words, and Deanna touched on this as well, I actually hate the term vegan. I despise the word vegetarian because that means nothing. What those terms are just by pure definition is what we actually eliminate from our diet. They don't at all discuss or focus on what we should be adding into our diet. So this is not a lecture about going vegan. This is not a lecture about going vegetarian. It's a lecture about getting most of your food from the plant kingdom. If you decide to add animal products into your life and into your food, then do it very sparingly. And, you know, no more than 1 to 3 times a week. And for the average American, they're doing about 1 to 3 times of animal protein a day. You know, they're having eggs for breakfast, a tuna salad for lunch, then some chicken for dinner. It's too much. It's way too much animal protein. We don't thrive on it. And it becomes a state of disease when we have that much animal protein. We want to focus energies on organic, free-range animal products. You know, if you're something that is a vegan because of animal rights issue, well, then that's something completely different. But again, with this is something along with the oil that should be really, really, really limited into the body because we don't need any meat whatsoever to thrive. But if you decide to add that back into your diet, I just want you to do it with limitations and also with some conscious effort on what you're purchasing. Now, the white meat myth. So this is my favorite when the patients come in and I always, first question I ask is, how's your diet? You know, they just had a stent, they just had open heart surgery, they just got on oxygen, and they say, oh, you know, I'm eating, my doctor told me to switch to chicken and fish. And, you know, I don't say anything at first, okay, you know, what else are you eating with that? Chicken and fish aren't broccoli, so they're not going to heal the body. And so when you compare the two, they're the same. They're both in the animal kingdom. And what we find through different research is that when folks actually make the switch from beef to chicken and fish, they end up consuming more of it. And so they end up getting worse over time because it's not about whether it's a swimmer, a crawler, or a walker. It's about the fact of how much are you eating of that particular animal protein. So those patients tend to get worse over time when they switch from beef to chicken. Here's one of the reasons. When you compare beef to chicken, their fat content is very similar. About 30% for a very, very lean cut of beef, about 23% for the leanest white breast meat chicken. So again, it's not a low-fat food. It's not an apple. You know, it's something, too, that people don't equate that. But the problem, like I stated, is the serving size. So for beef, people know that that's bad for us. They consume a smaller quantity, but when they have chicken, they have a larger amount. And so you end up consuming more fat down the road. Here's the most staggering thing that people I don't think understand is that the cholesterol amount in 4 ounces of beef or chicken is identical. It's exactly the same. And again, when we end up consuming a higher quantity of chicken or fish, we ultimately then end up consuming more cholesterol in our diet. So again, this is not anything that helps us thrive or heals our blood cells whatsoever. Processed meat. Now, I didn't include that at all with the 1 to 3 times weekly. Processed meat is not real food. Boar's head does not make any real meat. I will never be a spokesperson for Boar's Head. So with this, you have the bacon, the sausage, the hot dogs, the pepperoni, the ham, the packaged lunch meat. You know, my patients say, oh, you know, what about once a year my birthday? I say, why would you want to celebrate your life with something that kills you? It just, I don't understand. This is not food. It's the nitrites, the nitrates within these processed foods that lead to many, many known cancers. Not only that, but they're usually laden with sugar, salt, and oil. So the things that people are trying to avoid in the diet. So for a diabetic, any type of processed meat is devastating for you. You're better off probably having a cupcake than you are having a hot dog. This is a study done on low-fat turkey meat, breast meat. So 1.8-ounce serving of low-fat processed deli meat, and again, turkey was used, about a 19% higher risk for diabetes. And again, if you take a look at the ingredients, okay, turkey breast, is that a food? Yeah. Okay, then you have water, fine. You have cultured corn sugar. Is that food? No, that's not. It's sugar. And then we can take contains less than 2%, which that is a real good spin. All right, so we have salt. No. Vinegar, fine. We have sodium phosphates. What's that? Salt. Sodium ascorbate. What's that? Salt. Sodium nitrate. And a wicked salt and a preservative. And then the turkey wasn't browned enough, so we added caramel coloring. Okay, so this is not a food. And this is what we find in our typical lunch meat turkey. So instead of having lunch meat, have hummus on a sandwich. Have avocado, something that's rich, creamy, something that's very satiating for the palate. Let's talk a little bit about the disease states. I wanted to focus on cancer. 40% of all cancers can be prevented with diet and exercise. 40% if we just ate a little differently and moved a little bit more. So in 2010, there was a report that reviewed over 7,000 different studies to determine the best practices for cancer prevention. Here's what they are. Number one, stay as lean as possible without being underweight. Number two, avoiding processed meat. Three, limiting red meat to one serving per week. Four, reducing and avoiding salt. Five, limiting the alcohol consumption. Six, eating foods of predominantly plant origin and plant meals around fruits and vegetables. Seven, eat foods, limit supplements. Supplements can end up doing more harm than good, especially multivitamins. Eight, exercise 30 minutes a day. Nine, avoid sugar, sugary drinks, and foods high in fat. And number 10, mothers should breastfeed off their own milk, not from another species' milk. So this was found, again, over 7,000 large studies. This is what they came up with. And this is actually on the American Cancer Society website, which I was actually kind of impressed about. Again, going back to PCRM's power plate, our plate should be full of plant food, fruits, vegetables, legumes, and whole grains, guys. That's what we want to focus our energies on. I wanted to quickly show this. This is actually from Dr. Esselstyn's book, Prevent and Reverse Heart Disease. Anyone read that book, Prevent and Reverse Heart Disease? Okay. If you have known heart disease or you have a loved one that has struggling with, has had stents, heart attacks, open heart surgery, I highly recommend the book. It's amazing. If you take a look at the LAD, the left anterior descending artery of this particular patient, they were told that they could not have stents, they could not have open heart surgery because the vessel didn't lend itself to that. So basically the surgeon said, there's nothing I can do for you. Good luck, here's a statin. Well, after 6 months, that patient didn't get better, of course. That patient actually got worse. So he went to Dr. Esselstyn, and all Dr. Esselstyn did was put him on a plant-based diet. A plant-based diet, at this point, he wasn't using statins in any of his study. Look at the difference between his LAD. You can't ever, 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 ever get that result with any statin, with any type of angiotensive medicine for blood pressure, with any type of beta blocker. It just doesn't happen. We got this with food, and it's amazing how quickly it happens. Again, firsthand in working with the heart patients, I see that when they make the change, they get better. It is truly that simple. When they consume animal foods or they cheat, then we see their cath go right back. And so for a lot of the folks who have what we call multiple disease in their vessels or multiple vessel disease, we actually encourage them to do no animal protein whatsoever because even a little bit can lead to a higher acceleration within that blockage. So food from the earth. and this is really what I want to focus on and talk a little bit about implementation, is that really anything that comes from the earth supplies us with the nutrients we need. We get to get back from basics. 40 million years we've thrived on this earth, eating what this earth provides for us. It wasn't until the last century that we started to really mess with our food and create this type of food industry and food-like substance that's now hitting us with this chronic disease. I really want you to encourage to return to that and avoid that fake food that's within every grocery store shelf. You know, even Whole Foods or Richards has an element of fake food, so it's getting back to that holistic, real whole food. So first steps, and for this group, I'm sure most of you have seen this, but who has not seen the documentary Forks Over Knives? This would be something that I would highly encourage you to watch as a first step. Because it's Heart Month, Cardiac Rehab is actually sponsoring a viewing, and that's next Wednesday, and that's going to be at the Institute for Advanced Medicine, HealthFit, on Clark Road in Rand. So we're doing a showing of Forks Over Knives next Wednesday at noon, and the community is welcome to attend that. They would want you to pre-register for that, so I can give you the phone number if you're interested. You can come after me afterwards, or if you have pen and paper, I'll give it to you right now. It's 941-917-6139, and you can register to actually see the viewing. If not, Netflix has it to rent for you. Okay. The next thing would be stocking your pantry or your fridge with fruits, vegetables, nuts, and seeds. And so stocking it with real food so you have it there to access. You know, my friends with children who say, oh, you know, well, my kids eat junk food, I can't do anything about it. And I say, well, who does the grocery shopping? Who pays for the food? So if you don't have it in the house, then you're not going to eat it at home. And so making sure that you have food that's nourishing and lovely to eat as opposed to that dead food that we find in most people's pantries. Now, if you are nowhere near being in a plant-based diet right now, that's okay. Everyone has a different journey. Everyone has a different starting point. You know, I grew up on hamburgers and french fries and meatloaf and potatoes growing up in Michigan. I was not this at all, even 20 years ago. And so everyone has a different path, a different journey. So what I empower you to do is start with one plant-based meal. And it could be as simple as brown rice noodles from Trader Joe's with a jar of really good tomato sauce from Whole Foods. It could be that simple and that lazy. It can start off that basic and that simple. Or maybe a corn tortilla with some guacamole on it and some grilled peppers, onions, and mushrooms, maybe topped with some salsa. So again, it doesn't have to be complicated, but it just has to be real basic food. Next thing I'd like you to try to do is purchase a plant-based cookbook. There's tons out there. My gosh, if you go to Amazon.com and just Google or put in the search line plant-based cookbook, you're probably going to get well over 300 choices. And again, if you wanted some more guidance or information, I can steer you in the right direction of what cookbooks I feel would be good starter cookbooks for the person who's trying to get more into this. This is a fantastic website. Has anyone been on nutritionmd.org? Okay. This is actually a fantastic get started, you know, basic plant-based eating for the dummies 101. It's excellent. And what I like about this website is you register and it's free. And then what you do is you can actually pick what you want for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And then what the website does is it spits out a grocery list, it spits out recipes for you, and it's really, really easy to use, and it's something that can help you to plan your meals, which is very important. It's very important to plan ahead of time of what you're going to be eating to create success. This gives you an example of the shopping list that comes up based on your selections that you do. So it tells us that we need to purchase these particular, this is what we've picked, and down below it's going to tell us what we need from the grocery store. So it's really neat. It's really a great tool, again, to help anyone get started on consuming more whole plant-based foods within the diet. So this recipe I put up just because it's fun, and it's banana French toast, so life doesn't have to be boring. We don't have to just chew on broccoli and carrot sticks. So this gives you a sample of what this is encompassing. So two medium bananas, some soy milk. If you're not into soy, you can do almond-based milk, any non-dairy milk. It comes maple syrup, some cinnamon, some whole wheat bread or any type of whole grain bread. And then this calls for vegetable oil spray. I wouldn't even use that in the pan. And I've actually made this recipe, and it's excellent. So it's banana French toast that has no added oil or salt. Does not need that within the system, or flour for that matter. So other ways that we can implement and build within it, just to give you some samples to kind of get your wheels churning. For breakfast, cinnamon raisin oatmeal, blueberry pancakes, hot whole wheats with dates, sprouted wheat toast with berries, fantastic fruit and green smoothies. Smoothies are a great way to start to get you thinking about more plant-based foods and making it easy and attainable to get into the body. Whole grain porridge, whole grain cereals with soy milk. But remember, your cereal, your ingredient list should not have anything on there, SOS, so salt, oil, or sugar. It shouldn't have anything on there you don't recognize as food. Lunches and dinners are so simple. So we tend to get stuck in that chicken, broccoli, and potato mentality. But when you open yourself up to consuming maybe a different vegetable that you've never consumed before, or a different type of grain, it's amazing at the diversity of the diet, and it'll be amazing the diversity that your palate gets. You know, I have never eaten better and more diverse now as someone who's 100% plant-based as I did 20 years ago when I was, you know, a typical omnivore. So it's something that it's not boring. It's something that's just more of a learning curve for folks getting into thinking outside of the box of what they traditionally eat. So just some other ideas for you as well. So again, I'll end with exactly what Deanna started with, which I think is very apropos, but our food should be our medicine and our medicine should be our food. And again, right now we're in a state of disease, we're in a state of epidemic crisis with chronic disease. It's never been so important to think this way, and it's never been so important to take action into your own hands. You know, your doctor can give you advice about medications. A typical American doctor receives none to one in regards to their classes in nutrition. So they are not setting you up for failure, they just don't necessarily know. It is their job to treat you once you have the disease. We just don't have a preventative nature in this country. Tides are turning, and we have more lifestyle docs out there, but really it's up to you. It's up to you as a consumer on what's on the end of your fork, what's on the end of your fingertips so you don't smoke, and how much you move with your feet. That's gonna be the ultimate, really deciphering factor of whether chronic disease hits you or doesn't hit you. So I thank everyone for coming. Thank you. Yep.
We've timed to enter our question and answer period. The way we do this is to take a mic around to any of you who want to talk. And the reason we do that is that this program is being recorded. It will be on the uusarasota.org website under a Free Thinkers Archive. So if you want to go back and listen to it, give us a week or so to get it up. Your questions also will be a part of that, if you have any. We have till 11:30 if we want to, but if not, when questions are done, we'll dismiss, but not after 11:30. So Deanna and I are going to roam with microphones to find you. If you want to make a comment or ask a question, raise your hand. We've got...
Hi.
Hi. Thank you for your presentation. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about two things that popped out to me. One was the use of vitamins, supplements, and the other is arthritis and diet.
Sure. First of all, with supplements. So supplements are fantastic with known deficiencies. So if someone has a known deficiency of a particular vitamin or mineral, that's where a supplement would come in handy. But for the average person, we don't need supplements, and it's something that supplements can actually harm us. There is one exception to that. If someone's on a 100% plant-based diet, I would recommend B12, just because we just don't know enough about the fact our soils have been degraded to a point where we no longer have that good bacteria within our soils that get transferred to our fruits and vegetables. Even for folks that are meat eaters, they're oftentimes deficient in B12 as well. So that would be the only one that I would say that would be something that I would encourage folks to consume. But the fish oils, the multivitamins with iron or without iron, the vitamin E, the vitamin C, this is something that, again, the body doesn't like pieces of the puzzle. It likes to consume the whole package. And we can actually end up doing more harm than good. Over the last 3 years, there's been a lot of research done over folks who consume or take a multivitamin a day. And we now know that we do more harm than good. Those folks tend to have more arthritis in particular, more prostate and breast cancer than the folks who are not on a multivitamin. So I would highly encourage you to get your nutrients from real food, how we're meant to consume them, as opposed to a supplement. Now, on the arthritis front, I cut it out just for the sake of time, but arthritis is something that is an inflammatory disorder. Whether it is osteoarthritis, whether it's rheumatoid, whether it is juvenile arthritis, it all thrives and does very well, especially Sjogren's, off of a plant-based diet. Venus Williams, she's battled Sjogren's for a while and is now something that she's managed that with a plant-based diet, which I think is really neat. So she's becoming a great spokesperson for Sjogren's. But for arthritis in general, think of it. It is a inflammation of the joint. And when you're eating in a way that's pro-inflammatory, that's only going to accelerate that process, right? And so when you move and draw yourself more towards a plant-based diet, that helps to remove that inflammation from the joint and helps to ease it. Now, if you're already bone-on-bone, okay, we can help to prevent anything future happening in another joint. But once you're bone-on-bone, we no longer have that cartilage to heal, so that's a little bit of a separate issue. Yeah. Thank you.
Hi. I'm currently being treated for a knee arthritic condition.
Okay.
Not one time in my visits to my doctor did he mention anything about nutrition whatsoever, which verifies what you just said about the lack of training for MDs. The subject of cholesterol, we have LDL and HDL. Mm-hmm. Why couldn't they come up with a word for one and another word for the other? Because one is good and one is bad.
Right.
So can you explain the whole idea of LDL versus HDL?
Sure. So with cholesterol, just for the sake of this kind of answering the question in a one-minute format, we'll talk black and white terms. So LDL stands for our lousy or our bad cholesterol, and HDL stands for our good cholesterol. Here's the problem, is that when we take a statin, okay, a statin does not increase what's called efflux capacity. Let me define what that is. So HDL is our good cholesterol. It helps to transport and pull out oxidized bad cholesterol through the liver and take it out of the body. Now, when we increase the HDL artificially through a statin, all we're doing is creating more soldiers, but we're not necessarily creating effective good soldiers, and that's what efflux capacity is. Efflux capacity is the measure of how well that HDL is doing its job. And so a statin does not increase the ability of that HDL to do an effective job. It just gives us more soldiers. And so what we end up happening is that HDL then can turn on us in a very bad way. And so I'm not advocating for anyone to go and, you know, throw their statins away, but it's just something that I want you to understand that people generally give a very high regard for statins, and they put a lot of faith in them to turn their cholesterol levels around. But don't just look at your numbers. Your numbers are just something on the forefront. You have to understand what's happening behind the scenes. And that number doesn't necessarily mean that something good or bad is going to happen to you. It's just a risk factor. And so eating, in a way, helps to get the behind the scenes to help to give us the good guys what they should be doing.
I have a question about oils. Mm-hmm. I've heard very positive things about coconut oil. And could you comment on coconut oil?
Sure. So oil is oil is oil is oil is oil. Okay? It doesn't matter what oil it is. And so coconut oil has gotten some press because it's a product. We can sell it and put it in a jar and someone can make money off of it. But with a coconut oil, it's medium chain fatty acid, so it's different from the saturated fat that we'd find in an animal protein. And so coconut oil is nourishing topically. It's wonderful for skin and hair, nails. But when we consume it, remember, it's a fragment of a food. It's a concentrated source of food. And so it's something that, again, the body doesn't do well with fragments of food. It likes the whole coconut, but it doesn't necessarily thrive off the coconut oil itself. Now, if you're using a little bit with baking or a little bit in cooking, that's one thing, but we're just a nation that we're consuming so much oil because it's in so much of our processed food. So again, whether it's coconut, olive, corn, oil, is oil is oil. I have it on my legs and skin right now as a lotion.
Next question is here.
Yeah.
Can you help us understand the comparison between kale and spinach? And have you heard of any of the studies now done that overeating spinach causing a magnesium and phosphorus problem?
Sure. So there's always going to be those studies, what we call the reductionist study, or people getting kind of stuck in the weeds or the minutiae of what's going on. You know, rarely, working in a clinical setting, do I ever have someone who's come in because they've had too much spinach or they've eaten too much broccoli. It's just not the case. You know what I mean? Now, if we overeat any one particular food, that's not a great thing. So that term, everything in moderation, applies to whole foods. So all of our whole plant-based foods in moderation are something that's good for us. So it's good to vary what we eat in general, as opposed to getting stuck with just eating spinach, because spinach does have more magnesium. It doesn't have a good amount of absorbable calcium like kale does. So it's just good to have a variety of it. So I always encourage everyone, go to the farmer's market and pick up a new green or a new vegetable that you've never tried before, and then explore and go on from there. But variety is the spice of life when it comes to vegetables. Yeah. Yep. Next, Mike.
My name is Mike McCann. I'm a pediatrician.
Hi. And
you're quite right about our nutrition education. We were.
It's a shame.
I've just recently read the book by Colin Campbell on whole foods, and I must say that I think your lecture is the best I've ever heard.
Oh, well, thank you.
In nutrition.
Thank you.
I need to ask about your opinion about the Pritikin diet. Mm-hmm. They advocate, I think, a little more fish and a strict reduction in salt.
Correct.
And what's your take on autoimmune diseases and animal protein? It sounds like, at least theoretically, that there are antigens that cross-react with meat that aren't found in foods that might account for an increased incidence of like rheumatism and so on. Is there data on that?
There is. There's actually quite a bit of studies. There's a wonderful resource. It's called plantbasedresearch.org, and that has a whole slew of fantastic studies on different ailments, different conditions that have to do with nutrition and with disease in particular. The other one is nutritionfacts.org. Those two websites are going to be a really good, handy tool for any clinician or anyone who's looking for more research on that.
And your take on Pritikin?
Pritikin. So there's Pritikin, Furmin, Ornish, Esselstyn. There are so many different diets out there, and they all have a different spin. This one says a little oil. This one says no oil. This one says a little fish. This one says no fish. But if you look at the common denominator of all of the diets that are really successful, it's plants. And so that's what I want you to hone your energies in on, and then picking one that works for your lifestyle. But focusing on the common denominator of all of those particular diet plans, they all have the same message, and that's just eat more plants. And then everyone has their own caveat, because we've got to sell a book, right? Have to sell a book, have to have a program, have to have something out there that differentiates.
Next question is down here.
Yeah.
Can you comment on some people that are afraid of soy milk right now because
sure.
of estrogen-driven cancers and the safety of our food?
Sure. So Asian cultures consume 100% more soy than we do. All right, and they have significantly less cancers than we do, especially when it comes to breast, ovarian, and endometrial cancer. And so what we find is that it's not the soybean itself, it's how it's processed. A lot of that can be attributed to the GMO issue that's going on in our country now that we don't have in the other countries. The other issue is processed soy, so what we call soy protein isolate, which is in a lot of like the SlimFast, the Ensures, a lot of the processed foods, a lot of the processed burgers and hot dogs. Remember, that's a fragment of soy that's very, very concentrated. But when you take a look at soy and you compare it to estrogen, it's different. It's a phytoestrogen, phyto meaning plant, right? And so it's a plant estrogen. So it doesn't have that same reaction in our body. For folks with thyroid conditions, Kathy and I have talked about this, or who have breast cancer, there's actually quite a few studies to show that we should and we actually thrive on whole organic soybeans. But it all goes back to that processing and that really that fragment that's pulled out of that soybean that makes it not fantastic for us in regards to that. Yeah. Soy milk is generally not whole soybeans. There's one brand that is, and that's Eden, E-D-E-N. If you look at the ingredients, it's organic, whole soybeans.
It's also processed
into
a liquid.
Go ahead, speak. Yeah, it's processed into a liquid. Yeah. So yeah.
We've got another speaker coming here.
So that can be an issue for folks, but generally speaking, a whole soybean is something that we actually can thrive on.
Hi,
Any specific thoughts about diet and rheumatoid arthritis other than the anti-inflammatory kind of thoughts or the general plant-based diet that you're talking about?
Yep. So again, what I was focusing on was the nutritionfacts.org as well as that plantbasedresearch.org. You're going to find a ton of research on there regarding rheumatoid arthritis in a plant-based diet, that they tend to thrive not only on a plant-based diet but on a 100% plant-based diet. Again, it goes with that inflammation set, going along with connective tissue as well. So that's something even folks with lupus or gout tend to thrive significantly on a diet that's predominantly plants.
Thank you very much. My question is about soy and tofu. And I have read in the past that we don't assimilate the nutrients from soy unless it's been fermented.
Yeah.
Is that something you
Yes, there is some information that fermented soy is something that we tend to thrive more off of. You know, the tofus, maybe not the tempeh necessarily. But again, it's something that we going back to looking at big picture and getting stuck in the weeds is that I've never had someone come in because they have heart disease because they've had too much tofu or they've had too much tempeh or they've had too much soy milk. That's something that, again, we get stuck in these details, but that's not what we really should be focusing energies on. It's just eating most of it from minimally processed, so tofu is a processed food, so minimally processed food, and then maybe pulling in occasionally the tofu or the coconut milk ice cream and different things that are processed, but that are still from the plant kingdom.
Yeah.
I'd
like to know how you what you do when you eat out.
I love eating out.
So
absolutely you can. So again, if you're far from eating this way, well, then this may seem extremely overwhelming. But again, starting at one meal at a time. So eating out actually is pretty simple. I've created a document for my patients. It's called SRQ Restaurants. And so what I've done is I've divided it by downtown, Venice, the hospital area, University Parkway, about the restaurant, and then what would be a good idea to get at that restaurant. And it's pretty comprehensive. It's about 3 pages long, and it includes a lot. So if you're interested in that document, you can go ahead and email me, and I can email you back with that particular type of document. But that'll be very helpful for you. But yeah, it's really not a big issue. Yeah.
Next one's here.
Yeah.
If I go into your website, will I firstly see a copy of the slides today? And if not, how can I get hold of them?
Email me for the slides, and I'll go ahead and give them to you. On my website, you'll have the recipes, a safe foods document, but the lecture itself will not be up there.
Would I also find a list of what you choose to be the best exercise books for somebody with heart disease?
For cookbooks?
Yes. No,
I have
exercise.
Oh, exercise. So I don't have any of that on my website, per se. But with exercise, it's something that, you know, kind of a general guideline, not knowing you or your situation. 30 minutes of cardiovascular exercise most days of the week. We're not meant to just move on Monday, Wednesday, or Friday, or just on a Tuesday or Thursday. We're meant to move most days of the week. And then, of course, strength training is something that's extremely important, and flexibility training to keep ourselves within a good range of motion. So that's something that, you know, I could get with you on the side for more specific advice on exercise.
Finally, in view of what might happen in Florida next year, what's the potential effect of cannabinoids on this problem, on heart disease? Cannabinoids.
Cannabis.
Oh, medicinal marijuana. I don't know enough about that to speak on the particular topic, so I have nothing to add to that, so I apologize. I don't know enough about the research on whether the pros and cons with that. It's plant-based.
Hi, thank you so much for your lecture. It was awesome. My name's Roz.
Hi.
I've been living this way for many, many years.
Good for you.
Due to a health issue that doctors wanted to do something that I refused, and I've been living this way ever since, moderating and changing through the years. I have a question, just out of curiosity. What's your take on kefir water? And also, what's your take on totally raw eating?
Again, totally raw is, I think, it's an opinion. It's a lifestyle. There's thoughts on both sides of the fence. Some people, research have said that things are better cooked. Some people say it's better raw. I think that's its own personal thing. Again, no one's ever come to the hospital because they've eaten only raw broccoli versus only cooked. So again, I think it's just more of a weeds and big picture item. So I think that's more of a personal preference on which direction and which journey you want to go to with that and how you best feel on eating, whether it's cooked or raw food with that. With the kefir water, that's animal-based, that's an animal-based water. The kefir from the goat, the kefir?
No. Kefir is a culture of yeast with bacteria. You can make kefir out of a dairy or a coconut or a
yogurt. Okay. So if it's a if it's something that's made from a non-dairy or non-animal source, then I don't know enough about that to speak on.
Next one is here.
Yeah.
My question was just on the slides, but did you give your email address?
My email address, my cards are back there as well.
And it's right up there on the
screen. Thanks, Klaus. Yeah, so and feel free, I can email you the slides as well as that SRQ restaurant list as well.
Yeah. Hello, I'm Brenda, and
hi, Brenda.
I come from up north, so hi. I do take vitamin D because I don't get enough from the sunshine. Mm-hmm. But you didn't say anything about organic versus just regular fruits and vegetables.
Sure. So with the organic, again, it's how the fruit and vegetable is supposed to be grown, correct? So when we are eating more conventionally grown fruits and vegetables, just one problem in particular is something called irradiation. So let's say something has to travel from California to Florida. That's a long distance. And most conventionally grown fruits and vegetables go through a irradiation process that doesn't necessarily kill the nutrient, but what it does is it kills the enzyme. So it makes our bodies unable to actually absorb those nutrients. So when the studies are done on the nutrient content of an organic apple, for example, versus a conventional, they may not show a difference, but again, it's that enzyme that happens where it's unlocks that key to get the nutrient into our body. So just going back to simple common sense and basics is we should be eating fruits and vegetables or anything that's grown how it should be grown, not with added chemicals, toxins, pesticides, etc. So it's just kind of going back to that basics on what we thrive on without man's intervention.
Next question's here.
Yeah.
Two quick ones. What do you do for salad dressing? I was told that you need oil to get your nutrients when you have a salad. Mm-hmm. And then what do you do for water? What
sure.
kind, do you do tap water or distilled?
So again, with the water, it, personal preference, everyone may have their own different opinion on the different water supply and reverse osmosis and whether it's tap or whether it's bottled. So again, I won't necessarily answer that question because I think it's more of an opinion. With the oil, we don't need added oil in the body. Oil is within so many foods that we have, whether it's, again, an avocado or even an orange has an element of a little bit of oil in that, or the banana has a little bit of oil in that. So with salad dressing, that's actually quite simple to do. You could do a simple salad dressing with some crushed chickpeas and some balsamic vinegar, and it creates like a kind of a great creamy Italian dressing. You could do one that's based from soy sauce with maybe a little bit of a squeeze from an orange with some apple cider vinegar. So if you actually Google plant-based oil-free salad dressings, you'll have a slew of information that comes up. I have a couple on my website as well. And right behind you, Evelise Campo, she is owns a company called The Food Pharmacy, and she actually does cooking classes that are actually in line with what we're talking about today, and that's oil-free, plant-based cooking. And so she actually might be a really good resource for you as well.
Yeah. We have time for one more question, I think.
This is just a short question. Seeing you don't recommend sugar or artificial sweeteners, I noticed your French toast had maple syrup. Now, mm-hmm. I thought that was a sugar also. So what sure. would you recommend as an additive to make something sweeter?
Sure. So, none would be best. But if we're talking about the best thing for making something sweet, of course, you can always make something sweet with fruit. You can also use something like raw honey. If it's something that you, if you're true vegan, that's not something that you probably have. Also, you can do brown rice syrup, organic brown rice syrup. So there's different sweeteners that are less processed, but you figure any of those are going to be processed, even maple syrup. What I want to try to get away from completely is the chemicals and that really refined white sugar. So that's what's so devastating for us because it's so incredibly concentrated. But even with maple syrup, what I do at home is I do half applesauce, half maple syrup, and I mix it up, and that's what I use to top off if we're doing French toast or bananas, banana pancakes on the weekend. And that helps to cut some of that, that sugar content and the caloric content as well. Yeah. Applesauce makes a great topping for so much of everything, and so do pureed bananas. Yeah. But in coffee, in coffee. You know, if you have to have something sweet, you know, then you have to have something sweet. So a little bit of raw sugar. Just think of going closest to how it's naturally occurring. That's the biggest take home, is that you just want to have minimally processed as much as you can.
Yeah. Are we pleased with Jill? Thank you.
Thank you, everybody. Thank you.